Hello and welcome to episode 208 of the Rollo and Slappy Show. Today is July 20th, 2020. I am Rollo McFlugel, and with me is my co-host Slappy Jones. Show notes page for this episode will be mcflugel.com/208, where you can find a link to our sponsor, libertymugs.com, and also ways to check out our guest, who has been on about a year and a half, but we figured with all the craziness in the world going on, and even the craziness in the libertarian movement, it was time to get him back on. So Slappy, why don't you introduce our guest?
Yeah, our guest needs no introduction. And we go way back with our guest to the little Twitter DMs before there was podcasts. Pete Quinones, welcome back to the show.
How are you guys doing? I mean, Rollo hasn't been on my show in a while, but Slappy's been on fairly, I mean, last 6 months, I would assume.
Yeah, relatively recently.
Yeah.
Yeah, for the most important thing that either of us probably have done.
Certainly the most important thing that I've done.
Well, yeah, you know, and I would say that, I would say, what's the most important thing I've done? I think it's the documentary, but you saved some people's lives. So, I mean, I would even put it ahead of that. So,
well,
there you go.
Yeah, I don't know what to say to that, but thank you. Yeah, no, the documentary, which congratulations on putting that out, was very good.
Yes.
There's a lot of things we could talk about in this episode. We had a couple things planned. I would love to hear about your experience creating that documentary. We also want to talk about your recent episodes that you did with Dave Smith that were fantastic and really expose Black Lives Matter and what that other group called Indivisible. Is that what they're
Indivisible,
called?
Indivisible, yeah.
Yeah, pretty crazy. So I looked them up and found out, like, you know, you type in your zip code and you get their Facebook groups all over. I have a bunch of Facebook friends who are subscribed to Indivisible. I'm like, oh man, these commie bastards are infiltrating everything. So that was some really good stuff. So if you haven't listened to Pete's episodes on, what were they titled?
Is there a Marxist revolution in the streets?
Yeah, go check them out. Parts one and two. Part one is on Pete's show. Part two is on Dave Smith's show, Part of the Problem. Very much worth listening to.
They'll be in the show notes page.
Yeah, mine is episode 442. That's part one. And then it over on Dave's part two. I can't remember. He's in the 600s now or something like that.
Yeah, you'll find it was last week or 2 weeks ago. But anyway, I don't want to redo the episode, but tell me how you found these clips.
Monica Perez and Brad Binkley of the Propaganda Report, they were going on vacation. They were going to do a hiatus, and they decided to do like this very long episode. It's over 2 hours, and they actually played a couple more than we did, but I contacted them and I said, do you mind if I take those clips and, you know, Dave and I do something? Cause Monica's been on Dave's show, so she knows him and everything. And, and they were like, sure. Try to expand upon, you know, what we did and everything. And yeah, I just, when I heard those clips, I was like, I the only person I thought of was Dave. I'm like, I got to talk to Dave about doing a crossover episode, you know, do like an hour on mine and an hour on his, looking at these and examining them. And yeah, I mean, it's some of the most insane ramblings I've ever heard in my life. I mean, and it's not even ramblings. I mean, they're taking this very seriously. And,
yes,
you know, and Dave wanted to call it postmodernism, be inspired by postmodernism. I don't even know if I'd go that far. I think it's just really just manipulation. I mean, just propaganda, hypnosis, and neuro-linguistic programming at some parts of that. It would sound like updated kind of Leninism and Stalinism to me, just, you know, dressed up nice and, you know, polite. And I still, when I listen to them, I instinctively find myself shaking my head. You know, it's just remarkable.
Yeah, it's insane. One of the crazy, I mean, they were, it's hard to say what the craziest clip was, because they were all, to someone who cares about logic and reason and thinking and worrying about, you know, the tiniest little difference, it's the tiniest inconsistency in your thought. And I think everyone here on this show, at least I know Rallo and I certainly pride ourselves on being consistent. And I know, Pete, you always have been. But we take that serious, and you think about it, and you think through these situations, and you read books, and you talk to people, and you argue, and you come to your conclusions. And when they say things like, well, if someone else brings up a good point and you don't know how to respond, just know that you're right. It's like someone maybe made you question your opinion or your position, and instead of reconsidering your position, just know that you're right, and just, you know, call them a racist or whatever. I forget how that one ended, well, it was like, it's insane.
Yeah, just proceed as if you're right. If you can't,
that was it.
Or there was another thing, is validate your own ignorance. If somebody asks you a question and you don't know and you can't answer it, you know, just be like, hey, I mean, I can't answer that, but you know, this is how I feel.
Right.
And the other one was, I mean, my favorite is, and when I say favorite, I'm being facetious, is, you know, you can't question how a black person decides to protest. And when they say protest, what they mean, they're referring to looting or rioting or hurting people. And I mean, yeah, I can. Yeah, I most certainly can have an opinion on that. And I most certainly can call it out as wrong if they're hurting somebody or if they're hurting property. So yeah, I mean, it's just the most bizarre stuff you've ever heard. And when you consider how many people are like subscribed to this group and how many people are listening to these teachings, you know, you really have to wonder if all isn't lost, because it just, I mean, these are people who are obviously going to be voting. And, you know, I'm not one who's going to say, look, we're in real trouble, so get out there and vote. You know, I'd rather just make sure my powder is dry. But it's just insane. And then, you know, and then you look at some of the rhetoric that comes from the far right and like the Trump right and the QAnons. Then you're like, well, these two are just made for each other. Can we put them on an island and just let them finish each other off? You know,
I would love that. I also would love to send another group to that island. There are speaking of consistency or being libertarians, it's been interesting seeing the inability of a lot of libertarians to kind of see what's going on with the Black Lives Matter movement and not be able to see through the facade. And they took the bait, hook, line, and sinker, with these people naming their slogan Black Lives Matters the same as the group. So it was so obvious this was their plan. And Slappy and I, we talked about this, maybe not on the podcast, but offline. We were saying they did this on purpose, where if you have to enable, in order for you to say, oh, I don't like Black Lives Matter, I don't agree with Black Lives Matters. Now you're in this kind of like awkward thing where you have to be, well, actually, I do agree with Black Lives Matter. So it just, but then when you say you like Black Lives Matters, it's, and it's really so ambiguous, really, and weird. And these libertarians out there just, I don't understand how they missed this and they swallowed the hook.
Well, you really have to question whether the old adage that the libertarians are always the smartest people in the room is actually true or not. Because what I saw, especially after listening to these audios and everything, I started looking at some of these phrases like anti-racism. And these are, it sounds like if you're against anti-racism, you're a maniac, you're evil. You know, you want to own slaves or something like that. Well, anti-racism is a Marxist term, and what it basically means is that you have to constantly be apologizing for your whiteness, and you have to constantly, you know, if you see racism, if somebody's making a joke, you have to call them out no matter where it is, even if you're on your job and it could get you fired. You know, it's just, and then when the the account for the presidential nominee for the Libertarian Party tweets out basically a Angela Davis, a violent Marxist anti-white activist who and what the way that phrase starts is in a racist society, or I think it's in a racist country, it's not enough to be not racist. You have to be actively anti-racist. Mm-hmm. And I immediately recognized it for what it was. And I started to call it out. And I feel like half of the LP came after me and said, and their response was, you don't agree with that. You're a racist. I actually had one of the New Hampshire cucks, you know, say that, you know, I wish I was living 150 years ago so that I could own slaves. and I've had run-ins with this guy before. He's just a social justice warrior. I mean, disguised as a libertarian. I had Vermin Supreme come after me. Adam Kokesh, all these wonderful paragons of liberty and the non-aggression principle, and all these people who are just, you know, well, if you don't agree with what she said, it's like you have no historical context for what that phrase means. And, you know, the Libertarian Party, I mean, I'll speak on the Libertarian Party and give you my opinion of what's going on there. I mean, I think it's lost. So
on that, all right, a couple things. One, how many of these libertarians who are coming at you, calling you a racist, and anyone else who is in, you know, a similar opinion, Dave Smith gets it, Tom Woods gets it. How many of them do you, like, why do you think they're even libertarian? And what is libertarian anymore? Like, Nick Sarwark is the chair.
I don't know what libertarian is anymore. I mean, I agree with Jeff Deist. The term is lost. It's just, It's not even a term. Using that term now it's a joke. I mean, you got people who are saying, you know, like with the whole black bagging thing in Portland, where I guess they were trying to burn down the IRS building or something like that. I mean, how do I not support that? But, you know, people say, oh, where are the libertarians in all of this? Like, libertarians have political power. Like we desire political power. And that's the problem. Right. And that's one of my problems. That's one of the reasons I had to leave the LP, was because I can't make statements like that and be in the LP. Libertarians don't desire political power. I mean, what, you know, if I can just use the ring for good? I mean, it's just ridiculous. And you know, I've seen, you know, and another thing about the LP is, you know, there's this group that I really like, the guys that are in the group, and they're trying to change the LP. But, you know, it's like, all right, I'm going to start a party, and I'm going to consistently talk shit about half the members are racist, and we're going to lose every election that we get involved with, and I'll make sure to constantly ask for money.
That sounds fun.
That's being a member of the LP. That's joining the LP and trying to change it from the inside. I mean, there are so many quote unquote pragmatics who really just turn out to be, you know, how you have the old joke that libertarians are just Republicans who want to smoke weed.
Yeah, of course.
Seems like the Libertarian Party is really just a bunch of social justice warriors who I don't know, like the term libertarian?
Yeah, they're just social justice warriors. Yeah, period. I mean, I remember a few years ago, we had the whole alt-right thing in libertarianism, and they were just...
It's so funny. I've made notes about to talk about that.
Yeah, because they were just reactionaries, and they kind of got smoked out. And everyone was able to beat up on because of how ridiculous they were. And now it seems like half the people that were kind of on the principled libertarian side on that are now getting smoked out by just being their own reactionaries who just want to, oh, we can't be going, you know, out of their way. and bending over backwards to not be racist and to just fight the reactionaryism of whatever this racist, like this whole idea that the United States is a racist country is just absolutely absurd, or that we suddenly have a problem with racism in this country now. Give me a break.
In my opinion, you know what the most racist city in this whole country is? Boston. It's Boston. It always has been. It always has been. Ask anybody from Boston. Not the people who went to college there. Not the people, you know, ask the people who live there. It's the most clearly the most racist country, more racist than Atlanta. I mean, I live in Atlanta. I mean, it's like, it's so funny that I get called a racist, but I choose to live in Atlanta.
Yeah.
Do you know how the demographics break down in Atlanta?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know. If you just compare just the history of the country, or at least what we're told in the history, I just don't see it being like people are saying this is the most divided the country's been. This is the most racist the country's been. I haven't seen any like coloreds only water fountains anywhere, and nobody wants them.
Divided? That I think that argument could be made. Racist, I don't think that argument can be made.
Yeah, racist for sure. I just don't think we're I mean, I think if you talk to any minorities who travel through Europe to the United States, I think they would tell you which is more racist, Europe or the United States. I mean, it's not even really close, but as far as divided, that's interesting. Because we did fight a civil war in the United States.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that
do you think it's going that way?
If everybody wasn't so comfortable and everybody wasn't so... See, back then, people had more freedom than they do today. People had farms. They could provide for themselves and everything. Now everybody's just so busy. Everybody has to go to work to provide for them, provide for themselves. Mm-hmm. Where it just leaves them no free time and everything. I mean, who has time to, decide? Oh, I want to put together a militia and go fight and everything. I mean, it just doesn't seem logical. I think if UBI came in, you might have a chance at that because people would be sitting around, mm-hmm. But one of the things about the Libertarian Party people and really anybody who, I mean, and they really seem to be more towards the left that are like, oh, if you criticize Black Lives Matter, or more importantly, well, okay, so the people who form Black Lives Matter, they're admitted Marxists and will admit that. But the people down on the street, they're fine. These are the same people who would say we need to get the right out of the Libertarian Party because, mm-hmm. Chris Cantwell called himself a libertarian at once. Or, Richard Spencer called himself a libertarian at once. And there's an alt-right, there's a alt-right to libertarian pipeline, or libertarian to alt-right pipeline. And it's all from the right side. And, us prags and the LP, we're the ones who, we hold up the libertarian motto. We don't give a crap about negative rights. We want positive rights because, we stand for, and it's like, you realize that's all. These mottos, these Marxist mottos about, hey, you have to be actively this and actively that. And that's just crying for positive rights, which is not what, once you declare something a positive right, then you have to provide it.
So that reminds me, Dave Smith was going at it with the Libertarian Party Twitter handle today. And okay. he was criticizing them for, being really silent on speaking out against the looting and all the violence and all the negative mm-hmm. stuff about Black Lives Matters. And he's like, what are you going to, do you have anything to say about that? And finally said, well, you know what? Being against violence and looting, that goes without saying. And Bob Murphy chimes in and he goes, well, wait a second. How does that go without saying? But being anti-racist or being a racist doesn't go without saying. And it's just so unbelievably one-sided and hypocritical. And the other thing, it's funny when they keep saying that They're trying to separate the movement from the slogan and everything. Oh, it doesn't mean, just because they have, like you said, just because they have the Marxists in there doesn't mean we, you know, support any of that stuff. And we can, you know, we could be adults and separate it. Did you see what happened with James Harden recently, the NBA player?
I did not.
Yeah. Oh, Monica Perez was talking about it on her show. What did he do?
So he wore a face covering that was a the thin blue line American flag kind of thing. And he apparently didn't know what it was. He just thought it was a cool aesthetic, which is what the goal of that is. They want it to look cool and tough. And so maybe he's, you know, he's like, oh, cool, it's an American flag, and I like the color blue. And so he wore it, and everyone lost their minds over it. And the poor guy probably, when he found out what it meant, he was like, ugh. I'll believe him that he didn't know what it was. But that didn't stop everyone from losing their minds over it. And can you imagine? I wonder how these people in the LP would react to seeing James Harden wearing that mask and him being like, oh, I just thought it looked cool. I didn't know it had a deeper meaning.
Yeah, I mean, I really don't even know what to say about the Libertarian Party anymore. I decided to get out of the Libertarian Party not because of all of this craziness. I was still willing to, quote unquote, fight for it and everything. But I got out because when I saw the tyranny that was happening from COVID-19, what the government was doing, I knew that there was not going to be a political solution to it, because, I mean, it was politics that was doing it. It was the government that was doing it. So, and I'm pretty early on, I would say the first week of April, I realized that this was going to be, I mean, I said in the middle of March that people were still going to be wearing masks in July. I just didn't realize that more people were going to be wearing masks in the middle of July than they were wearing in March. And I mean, that's the reason I left, is like, I can't waste my time or money. And it's not really a lot of money, but I was planning to go to the convention and I canceled that. I mean, luckily they canceled that. And then when they pushed it back, I was just like, I'm not going to have anything to do with them anymore. But yeah, I mean, I just don't see a political solution to what's happening right now. I think the only way that anything can happen is to change the culture. The culture of, you know, the way police treat us, the way people are treating each other. You know, if you see someone with them. There was an article out today that Per Bielan shared. It was an FBI agent teaching people how to confront people who aren't wearing masks.
Oh, gee.
And I mean, how's politics going to solve that? I mean, when you have FBI agents who are going out there and say, I mean, so yeah, I just decided to go in a completely different direction. And then seeing the, you know, and Jeff Deist made a really good point back in like March or April. And he was talking, he was on, I can't remember whose podcast he was on, but they were talking about the Libertarian Party, and you know, he was mentioning like the Mises Caucus, and he said, why would you want to be a member of a party where half of the members hate you and are actively against you? Why would you want to do that? Why would you put yourself through that? What, to fight over a period of time just so you can gain this party that's going to have probably less power than it does now if you were to take control of it? It just doesn't make sense to me that there's a political solution to any of this, which that's why I left, you know. And there are still some really good people in there, you know, trying to take it back and everything, but they're gonna fail. I mean look, who had either of you heard of Jo Jorgensen before she was?
No, my reaction to when I was at Childerberg when that got, and they announced that she got the nomination. And I remember saying, if you polled most people, including myself, is Jo Jorgensen the Libertarian presidential nominee, or is she a right winger for the New York Rangers? I would say she's a hockey player.
She sounds more like a defenseman.
Okay, that's
more like a defenseman to me. But
no, that I don't really follow the LP at all, so to be fair. But I'd never heard of her, and I didn't think that was a possibility. Like, I knew Jacob Hornberger was running, and I knew there was a lot of people trying to get him in. Obviously, I knew Vermin Supreme was in there. There's probably other a couple other names.
Coquette.
Joe Jorgensen wasn't even on my radar.
Well, I mean, I knew who she was because in January we had the LP convention here, and she was here. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I knew who she was, but the fact that she won, what, I mean, yeah, like I said, by the time that happened, I was out of the LP. And I'm sorry I couldn't make it to Childeberg. I really wanted to come, but it just, you know, everything got so screwed up. But I'm going to the next one. I don't give a crap. I don't care what's going on. If I have to drive, I'll go.
You will you will have a blast.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, when I saw that, you know, and I'm out of the LP at that point, I'm just like laughing my ass off because all I'm thinking about is that, you know, that Nick Sarwak's name showed up in WikiLeaks, you know, about tied to the CIA. And I'm like, this doesn't this sound like the perfect CIA kind of thing to get a complete milquetoast nobody again? And then what happens a month and a half later? She's putting out friggin', you know, black power tweets, you know, from Marxist tweets. And I'm just like, this is why would you want to fight for this? All these people hate you. I mean, if you're at all right of center as a libertarian, whatever that's supposed to mean and everything, you know, I guess these days, if you're not for Black Lives Matter, you're a Nazi. But it's just, I don't know. I don't even know what to say anymore, man. That is a shit show to end all shit shows, and I want no part of it. And, you know, God bless my friends who still want it, but, man, I hope they come out and, you know, and start embracing some, you know, real action, you know, some, start reading Konkin and, you know, start 3D printing some guns and shit.
So didn't Nick Sarwak say if Dick Cheney was nominated as the LP candidate, you should vote for him? I mean, that's really all you need to know. Well, if it's the party of principle, it certainly doesn't seem like it. And so even if you win back that party, good luck to you. I mean, I think Pete, you make more a difference. Guys like Dave Smith, Tom Woods, anyone who's doing these podcasts and talking about it is making more a difference than spending your time and money in the LP.
Yeah. You know, that whole thing, that was all that stuff, you know, oh, you'd vote for Dick Cheney, you'd vote for Hitler. That was all from the debate that Dave did with Nick Sarwak and everything. Oh, and after that debate, there was a get together at Gene Epstein's loft, and it's about two and a half blocks away. And I actually walked from the event to Gene's loft with Sarwak. Jeez. And I talked to him the whole way. And I mean,
he's a nice guy. By the time
I was done with the walk, I mean, I was just like, I don't want to have anything to do with this guy.
He doesn't seem likable.
No, he's not at all. I don't know if it might be autism, some level of the spectrum. I'm pretty sure that's there and everything, but it is just I think what it is people who've been in the LP for a long time, and especially the pragmatics, that caucus, and a lot of the just more milquetoast libertarians, not hardcore libertarians, are race to be perceived as a racist to them is like worse than dropping bombs on children. And
clearly
it's just gotten to that point with the LP where, and with a lot of libertarianism in general, where people these days just don't want to be perceived as racist. And, you know, I mean, I still always laugh when, you know, Peter Arquiñones gets accused of being a racist and everything, but, I mean, what can you do? I mean, Eric Chalai gets called the Nazi and everything. So it's a clown. We're in clown world, man. And I'm just going to do my own thing and keep doing my podcast, make a couple more, make as many documentaries as we can and just keep trying to educate people and trying to move the needle. But politics isn't going to do it. I mean, come on. Look at the last 6 months. Politics is what's done this. The solution's not within it. It's going to be without.
So speaking of that, this is a perfect transition because I think I have the solution to the race problems in this country and the world over. And I'm pulling this from the Associated Press. Today, they announced that they are updating their style. And the title of this blog post is Why We Will Lowercase White. So I want to read the first two, maybe three paragraphs here. I remember this is really going to change things for the better. So here we go.
I'm starting to doubt that.
Yeah. It's funny. My coworker, let me read this. There was clear desire and reason to capitalize black. Most notably, people who are black have strong historical and cultural commonalities, even if they are from different parts of the world, and even if they now live in different parts of the world. That includes the shared experience of discrimination due solely to the color of one's skin. There is at this time less support for capitalizing white. White people generally do not share the same history and culture or the experience of being discriminated against because of skin color. In addition, we are a global news organization, and in much of the world there is considerable disagreement, ambiguity, and confusion about whom the term includes. So that it goes on a little bit more, but I just want to thank the person who sat there and said, you know what's a problem? That the word black isn't capitalized. And actually, last week, my coworker sent me an article and he said, is there anything weird about this article? And it was about some case where there was like a black guy shot some white guys in self-defense. And I'm reading the article. I'm like, I don't really know what you're going for. And he goes, look at the words black and white. They capitalize black, but not white. And then I saw something else about it this morning. Or he sent me something that he found about it. And I see this pop up. And it's like, holy cow. Like, who in the world sat there and thought about this? And then here's the best thing about this is that they're saying that black people are all basically the same. And that white people, but, and then on the other side, white people are all different, have different histories and cultures, different experiences. But then again, you know, that means that all white people are also just racist. So it's like just basic consistency or any sense of logic or just this would be like, how is this not extremely racist? That we're like, oh, well, you know, black people are all basically the same. So that means we can capitalize the letter in their name. It's just, it's absolute absurdity.
Well, I mean, I think Dave Smith put it best is, you know, you're in an argument with somebody and you're being consistent and they're not, and you call out their inconsistency and they're like, I don't care.
Yeah.
And, you know, and our friend Vin Armani, he's referring, sorry, I had to do that. but certain people referred to the Dark Ages. Mm-hmm. He's calling this the Dim Age.
It's not a bad idea.
People are really dim. You know, they're not bright.
That's spot on.
You know, and I mean, that is just so perfect.
Yeah, it's good.
We're just not. I mean, what's funny is, you know, being at the Mises Institute last week, you know, everyone I talked to is bright. I'm talking to these 19-year-old kids who are like, I'm like, man, I need
gives to, you hope.
I'm like, I need to shut up. This kid might know more than I do. You know, it's like I don't want to expose myself here. But you're having these conversations with these people, and I was sitting there with Per Bielan, and I was like, think about this, man. The conversation we're having right now, just about economics. If you go out there and you try to have that conversation, or if you just even try to have a conversation about the non-aggression principle, I mean, talk about basics with like a normal person, they look at you like you're insane. You know, it was like Eric, you know, Eric LaPreeze? Mm-hmm. He lives over mm-hmm. here. Yeah. Yep. He was, somebody had tweeted last week that talking about the letter and Chomsky, and they were trying to cancel Chomsky. And somebody had tweeted that, you know, if you want to find out what Chomsky means, you can just email him. Anyone who emails him, he'll email you back and everything. And I said, you know, and I retweeted and I said, this is 100%. I've emailed Chomsky many times. And, you know, he always gets back to me. He's always cordially, always answers my question. You know, sometimes it might take some time to get back, but he's always nice and everything. And Eric goes, what is it about? And he called me brilliant, which, I mean, he obviously doesn't know me. He said, what is it about brilliant people wanting to talk to each other, even if they don't agree on stuff? And I was talking to Pear about that. And I was like, well, it's because sometimes we're the only people who can talk to each other. Who can understand ourselves. You try to talk to somebody on the street about what we're talking about, they look at you like you're from another planet. So even if you don't agree with somebody who can think on your level, and I mean, I can't think on Chomsky's level, but, you know, I'm fractionally there. I want to talk to somebody like him because I can say things to somebody like that I can't say to, you know, a normal, you know, people I work with. So, you know, so I mean that should tell you that look at where we're at. I mean, we're lost as a quote unquote civilization. And where are we supposed to go from here?
I just hope that, because I think I said this earlier in the episode, I do think that even though a lot of people will pay lip service to this whole, you know, leftist nonsense or statist, not, I don't just want to say statist, not, but like the really, really crazy stuff, it seems like, especially with the internet, that it's getting mainstream. I think a lot of people just are quiet about it and just kind of go along with it because they don't want to rock the boat and don't want to get their head bitten off. But I think in their heart of hearts, they are thinking that it's crazy. And when push comes to shove, they'll back off. So I hope that the crazy, the really, really crazy people just eventually cannibalize each other and eat their own and just become so over the top and crazy that everyone just kind of says, oh, okay, let's just kind of let these people fizzle out. I tended to believe that a lot more 6 months ago than I do now. That's kind of my hope against hope that happens. But I don't know. I think it's going to get, I think we're going to go from a dim age to a little bit darker age in the short term with this. Cause I don't see people really, maybe they will, maybe people will stand up.
I don't know, man. Schools work really well.
I know.
Yeah. Well, you know, hopefully through all this COVID stuff, more parents are going to want to homeschool and, you know, or, you know, what do they call that? Unschool. Hopefully they'll be looking to get kids out of the system, but one of the reasons why I've been promoting agorism so much over the past few months is, you know, agorism is really the starting point is to take care of yourself, mm-hmm. is to figure out how to free yourself and how to set yourself up in a good way, and then you can, you know, look for like-minded people. And, you know, that's the new podcast that I'm doing with Jack Spirko and John Bush and, you know, and a host of people, and Vin Armani and a host of other people, Nicole Sauce, Xavier Hawk. That's what we're trying to do is we're trying to brainstorm to help people to, you know, get out of the system, to figure out ways that they are not so reliant on everything else. I was thinking about this today as I started writing an article I have to finish tomorrow. But one of the big points is you got to figure out a side at this point. If cancel culture is that real and it can come for you, you got to figure out a side hustle and maybe make sure that side hustle is outside of the system. Because there was a woman who lost her job a couple weeks ago because she put on her private Facebook page "All Lives Matter," and her company fired her for it. So,
crazy.
You know, you're Yeah, I mean, I honestly, looking for solutions outside of the system, at least having something coming in, growing something, you know, starting to build something. Because, and what's really weird is, I don't know if you guys know this, but you guys probably know this, that, you know, when Konkin was writing, and he was writing Agorist Primer and New Libertarian Manifesto, you know, Rothbard had a lot to say, and he had a lot to criticize. So, criticize what Konkin was writing. So, it's very, you wouldn't really hear anybody at the Mises Institute, because, you know, so associated with Rothbard, you wouldn't hear them mention Konkin. And in the last week when I was at Mises University, Tom Woods, in his speech about COVID, about the lockdowns, mentioned Konkin and agorism as a solution and a way out. And then the week ended with Jeff Deist giving, you know, giving his speech that he always ends with as the president. And he mentioned Konkin and he mentioned agorism. And that's something we haven't heard from the Mises Institute really ever. And it's like people, I think people are really starting to realize that you may really only be safe by getting outside the system. I mean, they could come for you and you'll be hurting if you don't have something going on.
Yeah, that's the real shame of the state and the what it's doing now is that, unfortunately for a lot of people, working outside the system isn't what is going to make them most productive and provide the most wealth, not only for themselves, but for the rest of society. But if the state and all these people that are their useful idiots are going to be so aggressive in trying to destroy you, you really have no choice but to, you know, go outside the system and maybe take a hit economically. But, you know, that's something's better than zero.
There's got to be an exit.
And the knock against, you know, and Rothbard's biggest knock against agorism, against Konkin, was always that, okay, you might have these small firms that can pop up and can, you know, provide food off the books and things like that, but you can't have these big manufacturing firms. And, you know, I know that this is so far outside of people's thinking, but Tom Woods said, he said, with the lockdowns, with them destroying businesses, how is it seems like that's possible. It seems like you people may be able to start side hustles that can provide bigger services, you know, that if this gets any worse, if they do another lockdown, or they say, you know, what they said from the beginning, what Rahm Emanuel's brother was saying, we need a lockdown for 18 months. Yeah. I mean, goodness. You could have to create a black market the size of what was going on in Soviet Russia, where the companies that were fixing appliances were black market.
We talk about it all the time on this show. The book, The Vampire Economy, written by Gunter Reimann, about doing business in Nazi Germany, and it was just. And everyone gives credit for the Nazis for being this, you know, great superpower. But even before the United States entered the war and World War II really took off in full swing, they, believe it or not, fascism is a really bad economic system. So they like destroyed all the resources. So the things that people, even normal businesses, had to do to skirt around all the state's rules, it was all gray black markets back then. So there's precedent for this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I just, this COVID thing, man, that's what really knocked me off my feet, was when I realized what was going on with that and what they were doing. Unprecedented. I mean, you're talking about the Spanish flu of 1918, and they didn't shut things. They didn't shut things down the way they did. And, I mean, there were masks and there were no mask societies as well at that time. It's funny if you go back and read some of that stuff. And it was funny as the cities that like didn't do masks had like less deaths than the ones that did. just wild stuff. But I mean, this is unprecedented. I mean, I've heard people say, well, you know, the economy will get back to where it is, you know, 6 to 12 months. And I'm like, I don't know. I don't know what it's going to look like 10 years from now. Because of,
yeah,
just because of the last 4 or 5 months, people don't understand, mm-hmm, like, when you stop production, what happens? I mean, Say's Law, production precedes demand. They stop production of so many things. I mean, you can still go to the grocery store and find something, and some things, the toilet paper is back in there and everything, but there's still a lot of things I see that haven't made it back onto the shelves. And mm-hmm, why? Because they stopped production. If they do this again, production is just getting back now, just starting to catch up, just at the beginning of it. What if they shut it down again? I mean, you're talking about shortages, and then the black market's really going to have to, black and gray's really going to have to be there to pick up the slack.
Yeah, I don't think people appreciate the steps in a production process for basically anything in an economy of our complexity and the scale that we have. It's not like you get raw materials, you buy it from the raw material company, and then it goes into a production facility and it goes out to distribution. There's just so many steps and everything. And there might be, I know just for my industry, I'm in petrochemical, and a lot of small businesses rely on a lot of these, you know, companies, and we're just an intermediate chemical company where I work at. We're not even making final products. And, man, if we have a slowdown or a shutdown or something, you know, that really hurts a lot of the supporting businesses that are around us, and a lot of them are pretty small mom and pop shops. And if they can't make payroll for a few months or something, they're done. They're out. And there's not really much there to take their place. When everything opens back up, it's like, oh, we need to produce now. Well, there's no more producers left.
As someone who understands economics, there's right by the grocery store that I frequent the most, there was a cobbler. And he's been there for years. And I used to walk by, and you know, Jen and I used to walk by, and I'd be like, how do you think he stays in business? I'm like, how do you, he's just fixing shoes. That's pretty much all he does there. And I don't have to ask that question anymore, because you know, in the last couple of months, he's gone.
Yeah, probably.
And that's not, it's not only the cobbler. I mean, restaurants that we've been going to for years are gone. Chain restaurants, mm-hmm, and I'm not talking about huge chain, mm-hmm, restaurants. I'm talking about, you know, a place that might have like 9 or 10 locations up the East Coast or something like that. They're gone, and they're not coming back. And this doesn't, because people haven't studied economics like we have, they don't really understand the implications of that, especially the long range implications of it. And yeah, it's really sad. You know, it's like, you have entrepreneurs that, you know, and I know that most people, when they think of entrepreneurs, they think of Jeff Bezos, who's over $100 billion, and Bill Gates, and, you know, people like that. But I'm, you know, when I talk about the entrepreneur, I'm talking about the person who saves up and, you know, takes a loan out that could destroy them if things don't work out. And then they start their dream business. And so many of those people are just done. I mean, it's just, they're just gone.
Lives ruined, man.
Yeah, I mean, and I told, you know, I've told this story a couple times, but you know, I talked to a CDC doctor, and I told her, I said, what you guys have done, you've destroyed people's lives. You've caused people to commit suicide. You've caused people to become alcoholics. You've caused people to be to go into depression. I said, and you'll never pay for it. You're immune from this. You're immune 100%. From what you've done. And man, I hated to do it, but I needed to get it off my chest at that point. And I mean, I could see in her eyes, she knew that I was right. And
it's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you look at the people really on the margins in third world countries that you shut down. You know, even the people that get hurt here, no one in the U.S. is going to starve. We've got enough accumulated wealth and capital that even when it's going to get, you know, kind of bad. Now, you know, I'm not saying all bets are off the table, but in the general, in the last, you know, couple months of this, no one's starved over this. We have enough that we can get by. It's not great. It's not good, but you know, you look at places like India and some places in Africa that, you know, now they don't have the ability to get the little bit that they get. Well, they go from just surviving to not surviving.
Death. Supply lines are interrupted. I mean, it's just and we'll never know why. We'll never know. And if some independent study group goes out there and figures out this many people died, do you think the mainstream media is going to report it? Do you think it's going to be on the news? Do you think the government's going to, do you think there's going to be a Senate committee about this? I mean, we're never going to know about just how bad this thing, this COVID-19 was. We're never going to know. They're not going to put that information out there. We're not going to know whether there was asymptomatic spread for sure. We're never going to know if masks worked. We're never going to know if social distancing worked. We're never going to know if the lockdowns worked. Because if they actually did studies like that, and they came out that the government screwed up, they're not going to do that. They're not going to point the finger at themselves.
Do you think this is the greatest scandal in the history of the world?
The history of the world? Probably not. But, I mean, the history of this society?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, clearly. And remember, it's worldwide, too.
Right.
I spoke to somebody in from Switzerland on, I think it was September. It was, no, April. No, March 16th or 17th. And he had told me that Switzerland had completely locked down the day before. So, you know, what's Switzerland's economy going to be like? And yeah, I guess Sweden took like a 5% hit on GDP or something like that. So far, I need to look a little more into that. But I mean, this is widespread. This is widespread in the West. Not to even mention China. And we'll never know the kind of civil rights abuses that they did over there. You know, the people, I mean, you remember when they were talking about, look at the carbon going up into the atmosphere. It looks like they're burning, mass amount, thousands of bodies, and, you know, the welding of the reports they were welding people into their homes. I mean, China is not, if you found out that China, that the CCP found out that like a whole block, everyone on that block was infected, and you found out that they just burned the whole block down with all the people inside, you wouldn't be surprised.
Well, they did that in Philadelphia.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they did that here. Yeah. So, yeah, Mayor Goody. Yeah, I mean, this is worldwide. I mean, who knows how the world comes out of this, man? I mean, think about travel. One thing that as I grow older, I love to do, I just want to fly somewhere, even if it's just for a couple days, and just hang out and, you know, just be away from home, see a museum or something like that. I mean, that's gone. I mean, I've canceled 3 flights in the last, ever since this whole thing started. I mean, it's awful, man. I mean, this is just, it really, I'm a strong person. I can handle this because I can recognize what it is. I mean, people who are weak and people who, you know, don't know what's going on, people don't have constitutions as such as we do. I mean, you can just imagine the kind of toll this is taking on them.
Yeah, it's been rough for me, and, you know, I'm still have my wits about me. So I agree. It's awful for people. We want to respect your time. We already held you longer than we promised we would, but, we mentioned this in the beginning of the episode, but I think it's a perfect free market success story and a great way to end on a positive note. But why don't you tell us about, how you used state money, government money to produce a great film. But you did not do that.
I did not.
Free market success.
Yeah.
Free market.
Just, you know, I was going to say, you've been talking about the agorism and doing things outside the system and raising money and, you know, What better way to make change than this? So why don't you explain what you did over the last couple years?
Yeah. So when we decided that we were going to make this documentary, we contacted a friend of ours, Jack Lloyd, who does Voluntarious Comics, and he said, really, Indiegogo is the best place to do a crowdfund because a lot of the crowdfund places, you have to meet your goal. So like if you say, oh, my goal is 15,000, you have to get 15,000 to collect anything that you use. If you only got 5,000, you can't collect it. Everything goes back. So we set the goal of 15,000. We got 25,000. Mm-hmm. And you know, we took some money out of pocket for this. It turned out to be a whole lot more. We're very happy that it wasn't only 15,000 because we used every dime plus to make this documentary. But yeah, I mean, it's great when you can have a vision to do something, put it out there that, you know, we require funds to do this. This is exactly what we're doing. And if you would like to see what we do, how we do it, and a finished product, you know, you can donate. And it was wild. I mean, I think we set it for 45 days and we had reached our goal within like 17 or 18. We had the 15,000 in like 17 or 18 days. When all was said and done at the end of the 45 days, it was close to 25. And then even over like the next, I'd say 9 months before the documentary came out, Indiegogo allows people to keep donating. And we still got, you know, a few thousand more dollars and everything. So, and then when we released the documentary, we told people we weren't going to charge for it. And, you know, can you donate so that we can put it towards our next project and put it towards getting Blu-rays done and everything, as we promised people Blu-rays. People still want Blu-rays. It's amazing. and we, ever since we've released a documentary, between PayPal and crypto, we're well on the way to, you know, we already ordered the Blu-rays and everything, and we still got a bunch of crypto left, and we're just going to put that towards the next project, which we've already started outlining. So, I don't think you really can't get any more free market than crowdfunding a project.
So where can people find the documentary, and where can people contribute to your next project?
Okay. The monopolyonviolence.com. We also have TMOV, the initials for the Monopoly on Violence, .tv. It'll redirect to the same website. And if you go there, there's a free download of the documentary in 720. There's a 4K download for $10. But next to the free 720 one, there is a link saying, you know, this is free, but if you want to donate, and you click on that, and it'll give you our PayPal link and our crypto addresses. And yeah, I mean, that's the way we did it. And that's the way we plan on doing the rest. The next one and the next one after that, we already know exactly the subject we want for the next two. So
good.
Yeah.
And this one doesn't, I think it's a good thing to show someone who is not familiar with anarchism at all, or who is scared of the term. You don't beat people over the head with Austrian economics, which maybe wouldn't be a bad thing, but you don't. You're very fair. You just talk about how bad the state is. You have a lot of great interviews from a lot of really smart people from all different strands of anarchism. It's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really happy with the way it came out. A lot of people were shocked. You know, even Tom Woods was like, it's not what I expected. He's like, it's so much more, you know, talking about mutual aid societies and things like that, talking about Chiron, Mexico. I don't think a lot of mm-hmm. people expected seeing stuff like that. I think they just expected to get beat over the head with, you know, anarcho-capitalism. And, you know, we even talk about the anarcho-communism, anarcho-syndicalism, and I think we give them a fair hearing. I don't know if we would have got a fair hearing in the other direction, but we give it a fair hearing. We just talk about the history of it, and I think it presents it well. I think that there's a lot of subjects we hit, and once we saw how many subjects we were in there and how many important subjects were in there, that's what is going to dictate the documentaries in the future is, well, this is a really important subject and we talked about it for 5 minutes. Well, let's talk about it for an hour and a half now. So I showed it on Friday night at the Mises Institute, and it was met with thunderous applause, a lot of laughter. There was a lot of people laughing at all the right times, and thunderous applause at the ending. So that was really cool.
It's good feedback. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Well, thanks for doing that. And thanks for doing your show, man. We love it. We appreciate it.
Yeah. Do you want to
keep doing it?
Do you want to plug anything else? We'll have all this stuff on the show notes page.
Sure. Free Mammy on the Wall podcast, of course. Patreon, patreon.com/Mance Rader. My website, freemammyonthewall.com/store. You can sign up for the same Patreon levels, but you can do it for crypto on there. And I didn't start a new podcast. I was asked to be a part of a new podcast called Unloose the Goose, which is Jack Spirko. And if anybody knows who Jack Spirko is, a survival podcast, 250,000 downloads an episode, clearly the most popular anarchist libertarian podcast out there.
Well, him. Behind us.
Yeah.
He's almost,
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I forgot. So he asked myself and Armani, Xavier Hawk, John Curtis Stone, and John Bush, Nicole Sauce. And we're going to add some people. And it's a great thing about this podcast is we're going to, not everybody's going to be there for every episode, and we're going to add some more people in as it goes along. And we're just going to be talking about solutions that exist, that skirt the edge of the system and exist outside the system, and talk a lot about philosophy too. So I think that's going to be we've done one episode where we just really introduced ourselves and talked about what each of us think is important and what we want to talk about. And the reception has been just fantastic. So check out Unloose the Goose. It's going to be wild. And I think it's going to be wildly popular for just because there's so many minds there to be able to contribute and help hopefully wake a lot of people up.
That's awesome. Yeah. I like that idea. Kind of the round table with a bunch of different rotating hosts. So Pete, once again, thank you so much. This was a really fun time. I think it's important that we kind of bring these ideas out and kind of show the people around us that it's okay to, not be so apologetic and feel like you're kind of, it's all nonsense. And don't be afraid to speak your mind about that, or at least feel a certain way.
Yeah. Don't apologize to these people. It will never be enough.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Well said.
So yeah, be sure we'll have all the links on the show notes page, mcflugel.com/208. Be sure to check out next week's episode where we discuss your tractor. Is it a racist? So thanks for listening. We will catch you next week.
Peace.